my notes, and Clayton taught Jonah and Nahum because those are connected. And I realized that in my notes we had skipped Micah. I read through Micah last night, and I can remember why I decided to bypass Micah. And it's not that it's a bad book, but much of the book of Micah is a lot of what we're going to read in other places, a lot of doom and gloom. So today we're going to skip ahead. We're going to look at the book of Habakkuk. And I suspect if I were to ask you what do you know about the book of Habakkuk, it would be about nothing.
Right. If I asked you if you knew how to spell the word in the name Habakkuk, I can't even get it spelled right. So maybe it's good that we take a look at Habakkuk. So Habakkuk's a short book. It is just three chapters long. And let's just start by talking about the prophet. What do we know? Well, what do you know about the prophet Habakkuk? And don't be bashful. What do you know about him? A bunch of crickets, right? If the answer is nothing, then that's okay, because the truth is, the only thing we know about Habakkuk is his name. That's it. That's really all we know. His name means embrace or embracing. I guess it's a derivative of like folding the arms. But beyond that, we don't know anything. Never mentioned again in the Bible. There's nothing in the text like we've read in like Hosea where it talks about the prophet's life. There's nothing there. So we know he was a prophet. I think as we read through here, we'll find that this wasn't his only message. I remember some of the prophets, it seems like they were sort of plucked out from their job, their regular job, and then told to go give a message. Doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems like Habakkuk was a prophet of God, had given messages before. We just don't have those recorded for us. So, all right, well, who is the book written to? Well, the structure of the book, and I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself, is really a conversation between God, Habakkuk and God. And so chapter 1, at least the better part of chapter 1, the prophecy there is about Judah. Now, there's nothing specific in the book that positively identifies who Habakkuk is writing to. It doesn't mention a king. It doesn't mention tribes. It's not like some of the others that, you know, where God says, hey, go give this message to Nineveh. And we know that, okay, hey, that's a message to the Assyrians. We just don't know that specifically. Dwayne, you were going to say something.
It seems like it kind of subordinates with Isaiah's prophecy.
Yeah, there's a...
Kind of after the destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah, there's some... There's some connections to Isaiah. I think there's more connections to Jeremiah, and we'll get into that. But it's written to God's people, and based on how we're going to date the book, it's pretty clear that it's going to be Judah that he's writing to, and not Israel. And then when we move into chapter two, it's not abundantly clear, but it looks like that's a prophecy about Babylon. And so as we get into it, we'll spend some time with that. So let's look at Dad. Yeah.
I noticed that he uses similar terminology as like the last part of the last verse to the chief musician with my string instrument. That's similar that was used by David in the term that was Selah.
Yep. Yeah, so chapter 1 and 2, it's really structured like this. Habakkuk asks a question, and God answers. Habakkuk asks a follow-up question, and God answers. That's chapter 1 and 2. And then chapter 3 is a prayer/psalm of Habakkuk. So It's almost like chapter 3 is a psalm and not really a prophecy. And so some people actually think that chapter 3 isn't really the work of Habakkuk. It's kind of added in there. But you're right. It's a psalm is what it is. All right. So again, there's nothing in the book specifically that helps us tie this to a particular time, like the name of a king, like some of our other prophecies. But there are some inferences that we can make from the prophecies. So let's look at chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days, which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed I am rising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgments and their dignity proceed from themselves. All right. So here is maybe our best opportunity to date the book. So first, what does it say there in verse 5 that might help us date the book? So Habakkuk asks a question, which we're going to get into his question in a minute. And part of his answer, God says something to this prophet that he doesn't say to a lot of prophets. When is Habakkuk's prophecy going to be fulfilled?
Before the captivity of
life. Yeah, but more specifically. In his days, yeah. So, verse 5, I will work a work in your days. So, Habakkuk is going to be alive to see the prophecy fulfilled. And so, what is that prophecy? Well, look at verse 6. What is specifically the prophecy that's going to happen?
Probably talking about the Chaldeans being brought up into the Babylonians.
That's right, yeah. So, the specific prophecy is, I will raise up the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? Well, the land of the Chaldeans was the southern part of Babylon. And in this case, like so many other times when a prophecy uses a city or a region to represent a nation, this is the same thing that's happening here. The Chaldeans is meant to represent the Babylonian Empire. All right, so Habakkuk is told, in your days, God is going to raise up the Babylonian Empire. And so what do we know about the Babylonian Empire? Well, they came to power, it's generally thought they came to power in 626 BC. That's when they destroyed the city of Nineveh, which was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. That was what we talked about last week with Nahum, right? Nahum was a prophecy to Assyria, to the city of Nineveh. And so in 626, the Babylonians came through and they took over from... took the city of Nineveh, and the Assyrians were gone, and the Babylonians were now the world empire. So we know 626 is when some people say that's kind of the pseudo or neo-Babylonian empire. Now, the Assyrians, if you remember from 2 Kings chapter 17, the Assyrians were the nation that took the northern tribes into captivity. So when this is written, we know then that the northern tribes are gone. They've been gone for about 100 years. And Habakkuk would then be writing to Judah. And since God tells Habakkuk that he's going to see the Babylonians come to power, then he would have received this this prophecy sometime around that 626 time. Now, it may be as late as 605, and the reason we say that is in 605 is when the Babylonians defeated Egypt and the remainder of the Assyrian army at Carchemish. And so sometime between 625 and 605 is when this this book was written. So that makes Habakkuk, if that's the case, contemporaries with guys like Jeremiah. Maybe Daniel, probably Daniel, right? Because Daniel was part of that first wave of people to go be taken into captivity. So it may have been that Habakkuk knew Daniel. He certainly would have been a contemporary to Jeremiah. He may have been a contemporary to Obadiah, depending on how we date Obadiah, and maybe even Ezekiel. So this begs a question, at least in my mind. Habakkuk is told, the Babylonians are going to come to power while you're still alive. So do you think Habakkuk went into captivity? I don't know. It'd be a, it's a guess, right? It's a we just don't have any idea. We know that Habakkuk was going to see the Babylonians come into power. It doesn't necessarily mean that he was going to be alive to see the captivity. But what's interesting is there's a Jewish tradition that says that Habakkuk owned a whole bunch of large plantations in Judah. And when the captivity happened, the Babylonians allowed Habakkuk to stay and live on his plantations. I don't know why the Jews think that, right? I mean, there's no biblical support for that. There's really not even biblical support for wealthy people in Judah being allowed to stay in Judah. The people who were allowed to stay in Judah that weren't taken off into captivity, it was all the poor and folks that had nothing. Not people like what they say Habakkuk had. Oh, right.
The rich people that have a lot of possessions, it's like you said, it's the sick and the old that get the stuff.
They were the ones that were left, yeah. So it sort of doesn't even fit with what we know of the captivity, but at least that's what some Jews, modern Jews, teach. So what was the nation of Israel like between this 626 and 605? Well, in 622, a king Josiah comes to power when he's 8 years old. And what do we know about him? What is it that he does? Was he a bad king or a good king?
He was good. He found the law.
Yeah, he was a good king. And so it's interesting that during this time, Josiah is probably in power because he ruled for 31 years. And Josiah was trying to get things right. And I think that helps us understand what's going on in verse 5. Because in verse 5, so Habakkuk asks this question, God provides an answer, and part of his answer is, look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told to you. So, it's almost like God's telling Habakkuk, hey, something is going to happen that you would never have expected. And it may be that because Habakkuk is prophesying under the rule of Josiah. That's sort of what I think. I'm putting a few pieces together. But just because there was a spiritual revival in Judah doesn't mean that everything was great. So when we look at some of the comments in chapter 1, if that's really the case, then if it really is during Josiah, then there probably were still some wicked things happening. Dad?
During the time of Hezekiah, in his 15 years that he was given, the Chaldeans came, and he showed them all their wealth, and he was told then that this is going to cost you.
Yeah.
That was kind of the introduction.
That's all in about this same time frame. Yep. Oh.
Their wickedness and their brutality, what really is wrong with, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm getting way ahead of myself, but, you know, Habakkuk's second question that he asked God is really related to the wickedness of Babylon. And I think when we get to that question, what you're asking now is really fits right in with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just them.
Yeah.
They. What we say or else. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. You think it might have been bad under the Assyrians? Get ready. It's going to be terrible under the Babylonians. Yep. All right. So let's talk about the major themes of the book. The book really is organized by two questions, that God, that Habakkuk asks God, God answers, and then a psalm or a prayer at the end. That's chapter 3. So let's just dig into it. Let's look at this first question that Habakkuk answers. That's Habakkuk 1, and it's verses 2 through 4. O Lord, how long shall I cry and you not hear, even cry out to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity, cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me, there is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. Now it's from this question that Habakkuk asks that it makes me think that Habakkuk had been given prophecies before, right? Because he sort of makes it sound like, you know, God, how long are you going to keep giving me messages? How long am I going to continue to, you show me iniquity, right? And I see trouble. All of these things are set before me, and you're not doing anything about it. So to me, it seems like from this, Habakkuk may have had messages before. But if we were to summarize Habakkuk's first, it's almost a complaint, right? I mean, it really, it's sort of a question, but it's a complaint hidden in a question. And when I look at it, I sort of summarize it in, why aren't you doing anything about the wicked, right? That's sort of the summary of the question. What, God, why aren't you doing anything? How long, right? That's how he starts. How long shall I cry and you not hear? So, God answers. And you know, just like when Job questioned God and God provided an answer, and maybe Job in retrospect thought, maybe I shouldn't have couched my complaints as questions. I think maybe Habakkuk, we'll see it for sure in the second question, but I think maybe Habakkuk might have regretted complaining against God. So, here's God's reply. It's chapter 1. There's just 6 verses, so we'll read this one too. Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it were told you. For I indeed am rising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgments and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, and they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes, and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing this power to his God. So, man, I bet Habakkuk, when he got this message, was like, oh boy, right? Because God is very specific with Habakkuk. And I think that's really interesting, right? The closer a prophecy is to its fulfillment, it sure seems like God is a little more specific than when it's a long ways away. So, this is going to happen in your days. And he says, basically, I haven't been ignoring it. And here's how I'm going to handle it. I'm going to handle all this wickedness in Judah through the Chaldeans, through the Babylonians. And then the rest of God's answer is about how terrible the Babylonians are going to be. And just look at the kinds of things that God says about the Babylonians. They're bitter and hasty. They dwell in places that aren't theirs. Their horses are fast. They come for violence, right? It's almost like they're not just coming to punish you, but they're coming for violence. Their face is like the east wind. You know, it's east wind is always described as being bad. They scoff at kings. It's just really interesting how bad the Babylonians are going to be. So God basically tells Habakkuk that he's not been ignoring the situation and that punishment is coming. And specifically, it'll be the Babylonians. Now, one thing that Duane had mentioned earlier is some of the parallels to the other prophets. Habakkuk, I think, wrote during the time of Jeremiah. And I think there's some really interesting similarities between Habakkuk and Jeremiah. And so keep your finger here in Habakkuk, but let's go back to Jeremiah 51. We're going to reference Jeremiah 51 a couple of times. And somebody, if you would, will you read Jeremiah 51, verses 20 through 23? Now, this is Jeremiah prophesying about the Babylonians.
You are my battle axe and weapons of war. For with you I will break the nation in pieces. With you I will destroy kingdoms. With you I will break in pieces the horse and its rider. With you I will break in pieces the chariot and its rider. With you also I will break in pieces man and woman. With you I will break in pieces old and young. With you I will break in pieces the young man and the maiden. With you also I will break into pieces the shepherd and his flock. With you I will break into pieces the farmer and his yoke of oxen. And with you I will break into pieces the governor and rulers.
All right, so Jeremiah here, I think if I'm sort of putting a time frame on when these things happened, I think this prophecy of Jeremiah is probably a little bit before the prophecy of Habakkuk, but maybe not that much before. I don't know why I think that. I just, in my mind, it makes sense. But Jeremiah here, or God through Jeremiah, describes Babylon how?
They break everything.
They break everything and describe him as, you are my battle axe and weapons of war. Oh, man. It's just, God is going to use the Babylonians in a way that he has never used any other nation. They are just going to completely destroy. And you look at there in Jeremiah, it's like they don't discriminate, do they? They're going to destroy all the rich people, all the poor people, all the old people, all the young people, men, women. They're going to destroy everything. They just come through, and they are God's weapon of war. Somebody had a... Eric. Yeah.
Totally destroyed it. There's one other passage in Jeremiah, I don't know if you're going to do this, 32:24, that talks about the how Babylon did that. It says, look to siege, Jeremiah writing, look to siege mounds. They have come to the city to take it, and the city has been given into the hands of the Chaldeans who fight against it because of the sword and the famine and pestilence. What you have spoken has happened. There you see it. And so I think there's also some historical that talks about how Jerusalem had basically built up its walls, and they built up a ramp to get in.
Yeah, and so you look there back in Habakkuk 1, verse 10. They deride every stronghold. They heap up earthen mounds and seize it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, at first you might think, well, okay, that's how the Babylonians came to power. But do you remember how the Babylonians destroyed the city of Nineveh?
They went under,
right? They diverted the river. So
this is also 2 Kings 24, right? It's the time period.
Correct. Yep. Yep.
And we know it's Nebuchadnezzar, and it's not just the Babylonians. He brings with him the Syrians, the Moabites, Ammon. He brings a bunch of other people with him to the fight.
Oh yeah.
The reason for it is because of the sins of Manasseh.
Yeah, they all, right, and well, Manasseh and all the other wicked kings, too. Dad, you were going to make a comment.
Along with Eric's, if you look at the Second Chronicles, you start in chapter 36, you're right after Joash has died. And by the time you get to the fifth verse, the one king came, his son, Joash, he's 23 years old, he really doesn't reign, but just short time, 3 months, he's taken to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Jehoiakim,
Yeah.
So we're, your point is, he could have been around at the time of Joash, but his description of the world almost indicates he's in that other time.
Yeah. You know, all right, so the thought of why wouldn't Habakkuk write after the first invasion and before this final captivity? In my mind, if that's the case, then why does God tell Habakkuk that you are going to be utterly astounded? It almost, to me, seems like, because if that were to happen, would they be astonished by it? Well, no. I mean, they sort of knew that the Babylonians were in power. That's why I think it was written beforehand. Okay. We're going to run out of time here. So, God basically answers Habakkuk and says, hey, I haven't been ignoring the situation, and get ready because the Babylonians are coming. So then Habakkuk asks another question, which is, I mean, you know, if it's bad enough to question God once, but now Habakkuk asks him a second question. And so it starts in chapter 1, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting? Okay, so this is not starting out very good, right? I mean, I'm putting myself in Habakkuk's shoes and thinking, right? So Habakkuk asks, the people have been wicked and you're ignoring it. So God answers by saying, no, I'm not ignoring it. I'm sending this super wicked nation, Babylon, and they're going to come destroy you. So Habakkuk is thinking, what on earth? God, you're going to destroy wickedness with wickedness? This doesn't seem right. That's sort of what I think is being asked here. But here we go, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment. O Rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with the hook. They catch them in their net. They gather them in their dragnet. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. Therefore, they sacrifice to their nets, burn incense to their dragnets, because by them their share is sumptuous and their food plentiful. They shall therefore empty their nets and continue to slay nations without pity. I will stand and watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me, and I will answer when I am corrected. All right. So to me, it seems like, if we're summarizing Habakkuk's second question, is Habakkuk doesn't understand why a just and righteous God is going to use such a perverted nation like the Babylonians to accomplish his will. That's sort of how I'm looking at this. And I may be missing something there. But then chapter 2, verse 1, I think is great, right? So Habakkuk asks this question, and then he's sort of this parenthetical. He's like, all right, well, I'm going to stand back and watch as God corrects me. You know, it's just interesting how he says that. I'm going to stand and watch, and I will answer when I am corrected. So he's sort of expecting that God's going to give him some feedback. Dad?
But he wasn't disrespectful.
No, no.
He was not disrespectful.
No, he wasn't, but he's questioning God. Why would you use such a wicked nation? How can you be associated with that? That's sort of the response that it seems like Habakkuk is giving. Oh, go ahead, Theta. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. But, I mean, he's still sort of, I don't know, maybe I'm making more of it than what's there, but he still is questioning God again.
I think it's like a lot of us. He just doesn't understand. And we don't always understand exactly why God does certain things. So I'm going to watch and see.
Yep. All right. So then we've got, really, the rest of chapter 2 is God's answer. And you know what? We'll read chapter 2 just so we can get the whole picture of it. Let's start in verse 2. Then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets that I may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end of it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. I'll pause for just a second. I think chapter 2 is talking about Babylon, just because of how the conversation is going. Some people look at this and think this is talking about Judah still. I don't know that I see that. I see Babylon here, but let's pick up in verse 5. Indeed, because he transgressed by wine, he is a proud man. He does not stay at home because he enlarges his desire as hell. He is like death and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nation and heaps up for himself all people. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his? How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppresses you? And you will become their booty. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnants of the people shall plunder you because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city, and all who dwell in it. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cut off many people, and sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not the Lord of hosts that the people labor to feed and fire, and nations weary themselves in vain? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the water covers the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to the bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You who filled with shame instead of glory, you also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. For violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and plunder of beast which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land and the city, and all who dwell in it. What profit is the image that its maker should carve it, and mold the molded image a teacher of lies, that maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols? Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silent before him. All right, so God here answers Hosea's second question, which basically his second question is, why is it that you're using this wicked nation that's even more wicked than Judah as your tool? And God seems to answer the prophet by explaining that he rules over everything, that God is always in charge, he reigns supreme, and you know what? If he wants to use this kingdom of men, it's within his power to do it. I may be exaggerating that a little bit, but all things are at God's disposal to punish the wicked and reward the faithful. That's sort of what I get out of this message. But what's interesting is God pronounces five woes in this. The first woe, and again, I think this is to Babylon, but the first woe is in verse 6. Woe to him who increases what is not his. Right? That sure sounds like Babylon, right? They went and, he answers Habakkuk in chapter 1 that he's going to dwell in cities that aren't his. So that seems to make sense. Verse 9, covets evil gain for his house that he may set his nest on high. And then what else? Be delivered from the power of destruction. It's sort of this pride issue. Verse 12, who builds his house with bloodshed, that absolutely was Babylon, right? They built their kingdom through violence. Verse 15 is really interesting. I think verse 15 is something that we can take heart to, right? Verse 15, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to the bottle even to make him drunk, that he may look on his nakedness. There is a lot of wickedness in the world, and there is a lot to say about those who press others to get drunk so that they can expose them in some way. And it's just something that still continues today that was a problem then. And then the fifth one is about idols. Woe who say to this wood, awake, or to this stone, arise. And that certainly was the Babylonians. They were idolatrous people.
This kind of speaks of the God's image of the world empire of gold.
Yeah.
Which was Babylon,
yep. All right, I had you to go to Jeremiah 51 before. So in Jeremiah 51, verse 20 through 23, Jeremiah prophesies that Babylon is going to be God's battle axe. Right? So then in verse 24 of Jeremiah's prophecy there, really 24 through the end of the chapter, we find about how God is going to repay Babylon. Right? So Habakkuk questions whether or not why God is using Babylon, and sort of embedded in his answer of I can use whatever I want because I control all of them is these woes pronounced on Babylon. And so Jeremiah, in the same way, where Jeremiah prophesies that God's going to use Babylon to punish the children of Israel, Judah, immediately after that, God, through Jeremiah, says, but Babylon's also going to be punished. So let me read Jeremiah 51:24. And I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all the evil they have done in Zion in your sight, says the Lord. Behold, I am against you, a destroying mountain who destroys all the earth, says the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against you, roll you down from the rocks, and make you a burnt mountain. And you shall not take from you a stone for a corner, nor a stone for a foundation, but you shall be desolate forever, says the Lord. We could keep going on. The whole rest of the chapter is about how God is going to destroy Babylon. And so it's the same kind of message that, yes, God's going to use Babylon, but then God will also punish them for what they did. It sort of speaks to the same kind of thing as our lives, right? If we want to do evil, is God going to enable us to do evil? Sure, God's going to allow us to do whatever we want. And God is allowing the Babylonians to do evil against the children of Israel. But does that mean that they're not going to go unpunished? No, they'll be punished for what they did to the children of Israel. God will allow us, enable us in some ways to do evil, but then are we going to be held accountable for it? Absolutely. All right, there's two really interesting verses here in chapter 2. If there were key verses, I would say that they're both here in chapter 2, and that is 2 and 4. What's said there that would make me think it's a key verse? The just shall live by faith. So where do we see that again?
Romans 1.
Okay. Where else do we see that again? Galatians, is that chapter 4? Or 3? Galatians 3? And where else do we see that? Hebrews 10 and 38. I didn't really realize this, but this is an Old Testament statement that is recounted maybe by Paul, if Paul wrote Hebrews, but three times in the New Testament, that the just shall live by faith. It reminds me of what Jesus says to the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees were straining out a gnat, and Jesus says they'll swallow a camel, but they'll tithe mint, anise, and cumin, that they'll tithe all of these spices, but they neglect the weightier matters of the law. And what were the weightier matters of the law? Yeah. And so when we look at the old law, do we really see those things? Well, yes, but they're not as obvious as they are in the New Testament. Faith is the same way. Faith is throughout the Old Testament. But it's not often mentioned. And here is one of those times where it's mentioned. The just shall live by faith. We know it's throughout the Old Testament. Why? Because in Hebrews chapter 11, we find all of the heroes of faith, and many of them are from the Old Testament. All of them are from the Old Testament. All right, we didn't get to chapter 3. Chapter 3 is really interesting in that it's a song or a psalm or a prayer. And it's almost like, all right, Habakkuk asks God a couple of questions, and then chapter 3, he finally figures it out. Because chapter 3, it says, verse 2, O Lord, I have heard your speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive your works in the midst of the years, in the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So God, Habakkuk is almost turned full circle. Now he realizes, I know God's plan. And so now he's saying, in your wrath, remember mercy. And there's some things in there we could talk about later if we want. But that's the book of Habakkuk. Any other comments?
One thing I think is interesting from studying the prophets is, you know, sometimes we question our own faith because we question why God lets things happen or does things the way he does. But if you look at the men who God spoke to, even though they spoke to him, they didn't understand his plan or what he was going to fulfill any more than we do today.
Yeah.
And even the apostles, when they were Jesus, they didn't understand everything he did or why he did what he did. So we shouldn't question our own faith if we question why God does something like he does.
I actually think it's good to question, to ask, well, why is this happening? Why is God doing it this way? Or, you know.
Remember that it's in his power.
Yep. Okay. We'll take a short break and get started here at quarter after.